Hi, this is Brad Vetter, letterpress printer and graphic designer from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to Cut the Craft.
Well, before we get started, we need you to tell us all about June. What's she up to? What are her current interests?
She is so good. We've been going for really long walks, and I've been running a lot lately, and so she's been running with me.
And oh, cool.
She is being super adorable.
Does she like running with you?
She does. I mean, she's walking while I'm running, which I think is super unfair, but you know, whatever.
Like, do you feel like she's mocking you in some way or something like that?
Totally.
She's like, oh, this is running for you, Brad.
Yeah, and then she'll like go chase a squirrel and then come back, and then she'll like smell stuff, and she's probably running like twice as far as I am too, but
yeah,
no panting, no nothing. She's just bored.
She's just patiently putting up with her dad.
Yeah. She's like reading books while I'm breathing so heavy.
Welcome to Cut the Craft, everybody. I'm Brian.
And I'm Amy.
And I'm Brad.
Sweet. Yes. And, well, I guess, Amy, you want to kick it off?
Yeah. Okay. So, Brad, tell us a little bit about what you make and the work in your process.
Yeah. So, I always tell people that I'm a graphic designer and letterpress printer. But some days I say I'm a letterpress printer and graphic designer. It really depends on how much time I'm, in the studio or how much time I'm, sitting on my computer. Mm. And, but typically I am a letterpress printer. That would be sort of the best way to describe my work. Typically printing concert posters, gig posters, that sort of thing. I also do a little bit of graphic design that's centered around the aesthetic and the feel of letterpress. So a little bit of liquor packaging, a little bit of concert posters, a little bit of everything.
Hmm. Wait, does liquor packaging have its own sort of like set of conventions for how you lay things out and stuff?
I mean, to a certain degree, you have to think about having the, you know, the alcohol content be a certain size, and
right.
The labels are particular sizes for, say, a Pinot Noir versus a beer can or something that. But there are some rules to it, but for the most part, it's having fun and making something look pretty.
Yeah. I think I find it, being someone who also is kind of like, I guess, caught between two worlds in a way, like between the bookbinding and the tool making for bookbinding, granted. I think it's funny how it's like whether you put graphic designer, letterpress printer, or letterpress printer, graphic designer. Cause like just recently I switched from being bookbinder toolmaker to toolmaker bookbinder. So I understand the like existential issues that arise.
Yeah, and I mean I don't think that I personally could be one without the other. I need the aesthetic and sort of the process of letterpress to work as a graphic designer. I'm kind of opposed to working on the computer, even though I do it pretty much every day and have been as long as I've been working. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I still look at the keyboard as, if you've ever seen that GIF of the cat working on the typing on the keyboard and its hands are just going up and down. Like that's still how I reference working on a computer. As if it's this thing I've never touched before.
Oh, Amy, I feel like that leads right into our second question, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So You mentioned a little bit that you take advantage of both, you know, computer work and then you have the balance of that, which is traditional handcraft, like letterpress stuff. And how does one influence the other? Do you think that your computer work influences the letterpress aspect or vice versa or both?
Absolutely. I think they both really respond and work off of each other. So sort of like a quick background, I studied graphic design in school. So I was, quote unquote, classically trained on the computer in graphic design. So I was using Illustrator and InDesign and all of those programs. And while I was doing that work, I felt so removed from the things that were 100% digital. And that sort of led me to, I was working as the copy boy at Staples, the office supply superstore. Oh. And so I had access to a Xerox machine. And with that, I started to print out these digital files that I had created. And then I would crumple them up and then rescan it in so that there would be all of this new distress in it. And I felt like once I started to get my hand into the process of these very digital things, I started to feel a little bit more of a connection to the work that I was creating. And that sort of jumped into printmaking. So when I started to screen print, which I had done before I learned letterpress, there was this this thing that I was so excited by, and it was the imperfection of my hand. So I wasn't the best at printing, so there would be this misregistration or this thing that was wrong, and I loved it. And I totally embraced all of these things that were sort of showing that I was involved in the process. And that started to relate back to the digital work, because I would, you know, I would then scan in some of those Xerox pieces or something that I had screen printed that had these imperfections in it. And so I started to do that on purpose digitally, or I would create something 100% on the computer and then I would screen print it, which would throw off the registration or the colors into something that felt more authentic to the aesthetic that I was looking for. And all of that sort of led me to letterpress. It led me to this crazy process of, you know, very simply letters pressed into paper with ink in between. And I started my sort of letterpress career at Hat Show Print, which is a 130 plus year old letterpress poster shop in Nashville, Tennessee.
Wow.
And while I was there, we had one super old Mac in the back of the shop, and that's where we would typeset things like every single date for Willie Nelson's tour. So, you know, it would be you know, every city that he was going to, which, you know, you could use handset lead type to create something like that, but you know, it wasn't really gonna affect the overall aesthetic of the poster if we had to make a magnesium plate of that. So while I was at Hatch, really the only time I was using a computer was just to simply typeset the names of all the cities that a band was going to. And so one of the things that sort of becomes pretty like prevalent in my work these days is the use of a laser engraver. And I had my first sort of adventure with laser engraving when I was asked to do a residency at MTSU, which is Middle Tennessee State University. Their fine art library there had a Ben Franklin hand press that was a replica, you know, of this older press, you know, just a beautiful piece of craftsmanship, you know, to create this thing. I think it was made by a couple of the guys who worked in the maintenance area of the university. And they were commissioned to make this beautiful press. And they had even hand cast, not at the school, but they had some hand cast Castlon created so that they could typeset, you know, things like the Declaration of Independence and all of the stuff that was so like antiquated and, you know, just entrenched in the history of printing. And these people asked me to come and do a residency there. And I never really had that connection to the history of the process. You know, I didn't care if the type had been cast yesterday or 200 years ago. That wasn't really important to me. And when they asked what I wanted to do on this press, I said something really digital. And so my initial idea was to just make a whole bunch of squares and basically play with pixels. So I would be using, you know, this Ben Franklin replica hand press to create like these overtly digital designs. And what that ultimately translated to was I created a font or you know, just a full set of what's called Alpha Blocks, which is an older typeface that is created by all of these small elements of typography. So if you imagine one being a cross and one being you know, a 90 degree angle, and all of these little elements that when put together, they create different type, whether it's really, really condensed or really, really expanded, based on all of these little elements.
So like basically you can like construct different forms that create different letters of the alphabet using these little individual components.
Exactly. Thank you. Cool. Yeah. So like curves, if you had, you know, this curve, you could put two of them next to each other and you would have the top half of an O, and then you flip those and put them on the bottom, and then you have the complete circle for the O. And that to me seemed so much more interesting than hand setting a page of the Bible or, you know, like recreating some of these older documents, you know, that would have traditionally been letterpress printed.
And right, right.
So to create all of these elements, all of these little pieces of what was called Alpha Blocks, I had access to the laser engraver at the university. And with the help of a student at the time who ended up becoming a really good friend, Heather Mulder, who actually still works at Hatch these days. She helped me use the laser cutter. And so in like 2009 or 10, we started playing with the laser cutter as a tool with letterpress, which was so much fun to me. It
like just blew the doors open.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, at the time, I was working at Hatch, so there was no way to really incorporate that aesthetic and that process into my day-to-day work. But it was something that definitely stuck in my head until the time when I had new access to a laser cutter, along with sort of entering into the time where I would be working for myself.
Cool. Dang, that's quite a journey.
it really is, yeah.
Well, I mean, so Brad, how does that sort of factor into what you're doing now?
Yeah, so when I left Hatch in 2012, my wife decided that she wanted to go to grad school. So we moved to Northern Illinois, to DeKalb, Illinois, which is about an hour west of Chicago in the middle of the cornfields. And we moved there for her to go to school in printmaking, and which was perfect for both of us. And yeah. I had a tiny little corner of her grad studio that she let me put a press and, you know, the little bit of type that I had collected over the years. And while talking to the printmaking instructor, he invited me to come and use the laser engraver that they had in the print shop anytime that I wanted. So when I was getting started, I didn't have as much stuff as this crazy shop that had 130 years of type and cuts and all of these beautiful illustrations. So I had to start to create my own. And I was able to use the laser engraver to start to build like sort of a catalog of my own images, whether it was stars or fun things like catchwords, like and of and the that are
catchwords.
You know, just one of those elements of letterpress that I really love. And so I started to use the laser cutter as this way to build my own collection, to build my own Hatch show print. And cool. I very quickly realized that, you know, the way that a 130-year-old continually operating letterpress shop works is probably not going to work for me as, you know, kind of a nobody printing in the basement in DeKalb, Illinois. So,
so what does that mean? That they were just, you would have a harder time, like, just with the space or with the customers or what?
Part of it would be, that I didn't have the clients. So Hatch was creating, you know, around 600 posters a year. So there was sort of this endless stream of work coming in. Uh-huh. And I definitely didn't have that. And then also to go back to, you know, the imagery and the type that Hatch Show Print had was... You know, it's probably one of the largest collections in the U.S. of wood type and images carved into wood and linoleum. And you know, I had maybe about 20 fonts of wood type or lead type. And I believe it was a calligrapher that had been in an episode.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. David Grimes. Yeah.
Yeah. And he talked about sort of the difference between font and typeface. So a font is any given style of type at a particular size. So when I talk about font, I'm talking about one case of type. And
Okay.
And with that type, you know, I could do a lot, but it was almost so limiting that I had to find another way to create new some things of my own mm-hmm. that weren't you know, from this tiny little collection, or wasn't referencing Hat Show Print in the way that, you know, I had been using it my whole career. And so I had to create some things that were my own. And I realized very quickly that I didn't have to make these individual things, that I could make a whole poster that was totally custom by laser cutting these backgrounds and laser cutting new imagery and new typography. And that was sort of a big turning point for me in the aesthetic, going from this very traditional form of letters pressed into paper with ink in between, and sort of stepping into bouncing back and forth between using a laser cutter and using my 60-year-old printing press.
So that's so cool, because then it's kind of like the more you do of one, the more it frees you up to do of the other. Like, once you've done a few things of letterpress, you then have digital scans of those things, and then you can take those elements out from that composition and like reuse them in different ways for new compositions that would then get etched on their own board to be printed.
Exactly. Yeah, I started to laser cut. I'm just gonna make something up. I laser cut a rooster that I used for a poster for this band called the Mavericks, and after I printed that poster, and it still said the Mavericks on the printing block that I had used to make that poster. And what I would do is then take that block to the table saw, and I could cut mm-hmm. off the Mavericks, and then I could use that rooster for a poster that I did for, you know, another band altogether, or maybe I could make an art print or something that would sort of be a companion to that gig poster that I created.
That's awesome. Or you could even cut up Mavericks and make a poster for someone named Rick.
Exactly.
Would you say that in a sense, like your these laser, is it laser engraving? You said laser engraved block.
Laser engraved, laser cut. I kind of okay. use the term interchangeable.
Like, in a sense, this is like the wood type version of getting like a zinc or magnesium plate made for printing. Is that
exactly
accurate? But you're exactly. able to still get that texture from the wood.
Right. So in letterpress, all of the wood type, all of the lead type, any of the old magnesium cuts or anything like that, anything that you need to print has to be a very specific height. It's called type high. It's 0.918. of an inch, so just a little bit less than an inch. And as long as I could mount my blocks to that height, then I could print anything that I wanted. And so that cool. That 0.918 is the height of a shilling on its side. What? And
no way.
the reason for that is so that you know, everyone would have this sort of standard to go by that, you know, was sort of universal around.
That's so
the
funny.
Country. Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's so funny, like the arbitrary nature of measurements. Like, it's just like, okay, it's whatever this is. And everyone's okay, that's exactly what it is.
I guess they were just like, everyone's got a shilling lying around.
Right, right.
Exactly.
I also love too that it like all started at Staples, where you were like sitting there scanning stuff, and then you were like, I'm gonna crumple this one up. And then it made me think that it would be so cool if you still had that ball of paper that was like in like a little glass baseball case that you could keep forever.
This is the original piece that I scanned. it's really so fun to like piece all of that together, because, you know, if you went back a little bit and, you know, my sort of driving aesthetic and the thing that I have always kind of been the most interested in is music and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And so I would go to, you know, the record store and, you know, look at the posters that were up to see what bands were going to be playing. And all of those prints were made at Kinko's. You know, they were all Xeroxed, and, you know, there was so much of this like punk rock aesthetic of, you know, just cutting the pieces of paper and putting them on top of photographs. And mm-hmm. when I started working at Staples, I was making posters for my friends' bands, but I was also just taking like the funny little clip art books that they had that you would use for making business cards. You know, if you were like the baseball coach, you would use the baseball image.
Right, right.
And those things I would blow up and make them really big and then shrink it back down so that you could see all the like dust and stress that was on the piece. And I mean, that's so similar to the work that I'm making today, where, you know, I thrive on the texture and the sort of imperfections of the process to make the images that I want to make.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian here, and I wanted to let you know that the John C. Campbell Folk School in Brasstown, North Carolina has just released their 2021 course catalog, all the workshops they have planned from May through December of this year. They offer classes in many of the media we've covered on the show, so you can bet your bottom dollar that they have something of interest for you. Speaking of dollars, scholarships for all their classes are available on a first-come, first-served basis, and of course are also dependent on space availability. For more information on scholarships and upcoming courses, or to request a print catalog if that's more your style, please visit folkschool.org.
Our sponsor, North House Folk School in Grand Marais, Minnesota, has an important announcement for anyone who is interested in their internship opportunities. The deadline for the application is February 8th. Internships run from April to November, and there are 4 openings for 2021. They have tons of information about the internship on their website, including a video and last year's interns information. So if you're interested, don't hesitate to hop online at northhouse.org to check it out. I think it's really interesting how our aesthetic always shifts to something that's like different than the norm. So like a long time ago, the quality of the product would have been a little, what am I trying to say? Like now we're interested in things that look like there are humans involved, but for a while people were like totally enamored by the perfection that happens with, automated production.
Right. Right. Right.
And so now it's like we're back to, oh, it's not made by a machine. So that's like this desirable aesthetic. I think that's super interesting.
I mean, that totally influences how I make my books and stuff like that, where I'm like, if I'm going to bother making it by hand, like I don't need to try to beat a machine. Like they're better than me.
Yeah. A lot of old printers would look at my work and they would see, you know, the scratches and the dents in the type, or they would see the sort of inconsistency in the ink and say that what I'm creating is bad. And I get it, and I kind of know how to be a good printer. I, you know, if this podcast is only the best of the best, you've you could maybe reconsider this, but you know, I definitely don't consider myself an amazing letterpress printer. It's the aesthetic of the process that really draws me in, and I think makes the work that I'm doing interesting, not because I'm you know, the most technically proficient, but because I see the value in its history.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think too, like when I see your work, one of the only thing I'll say that I get frustrated with your work is when I'm looking at it on a screen and I want to touch it and I can't because it's on a screen.
Right. Oh, I totally agree.
Like,
it's really something that I think about a lot. There's, you know, we work so hard as craftspeople to create this thing of beauty. You know, I'm hand setting type. I'm mixing the ink by hand. I'm running each print, each color through the press, one print at a time. And then I take a photo of it and put it on Instagram. And that's where people get to experience my work. It's something I really miss, you know?
Well, and that kind of actually, it's a little bit different, but it makes me think of a question where you were talking about, like, you know, show posters before seemed to be things that were more ephemeral, like just taken around town, plastered up on brick walls and stuff to actually let people know about the show. And you even mentioned when you would go to the record store and see those, like, you know, Kinko's show posters. How has, like, the role, I guess, of show posters changed? Are they still, are, like, the posters you're printing or were printing at Hatch, like, used like that still? Or are they mostly sold at the show as, like, a collectible memorabilia kind of thing?
So I started working at Hatch in 2004-2005. And when I first moved to Nashville, you could drive down the street and you would see Hatch posters everywhere. They were on the telephone poles. They were in all of the shop windows. And it was so much fun to, you know, go from being the person that used to love to look at the posters at the record stores to going to our record store. Shout out to Grimey's in Nashville. And seeing our posters hanging up on the wall was such a big deal, and it was so cool. And the longer that I was there, the fewer that I would see the posters. Like, they they started to stop being on other telephone poles, and, you know, they would only go up at a couple of the coffee shops instead of every single one. And when we got a job at Hatch, say I'm making a poster for Old Crow Medicine Show playing at the Ryman Auditorium, the show would be sold out way before I even got the job folder that said that I was going to be making the poster for that show.
Right.
So that kind of lived as two different things, you know, like, on one hand, it was really fun to just get to make a fun poster. Like, so we didn't have to worry about people being able to read the poster while driving in their car at 35 miles an hour down the road and know the who, what, when, where, why, how. Now we just got to make something beautiful, something that was celebrating that band playing in that town at that time. And that was such a great shift as a poster designer, because we really just got to focus on making a beautiful piece of art as opposed to this important means of communication. And, you know, that was really an exciting shift that, you know, it, one, I didn't feel as tied to the culture of music as I had when I could go to the record store and see my poster in the window, as I had before. But now there was maybe a little bit more of a tie between what that band sounded like and what that poster looked like. And that became sort of the next iteration of creating gig posters.
Yeah, like you swapped out kind of like the function, because, you know, the show, as you said, was already like they're able to just do that kind of promotion online or through other means. They didn't need the show posters as much of like a functional thing. So then it just becomes like this like celebration. So it's not like this really necessarily this really like sad change per se.
No, not at all.
I was expecting it to be like a kid like kicking a can down an alley kind of story where like, it's like doo doo doo, like Charlie Brown Christmas.
But
so that's really exciting though. It like opened up a bunch of whole new doors.
Right. And you know, something that is still important in the printing process is that, you know, I still have the power of a printing press. Like, it may not be, you know, the kid who the band hires to hang the posters up around town, but, you know, I have a staple gun and I have a printing press. So, you know, if there's something that I want to say, I still have the means to put that information out into the world, which, you know, just because it's not the gig poster going up on the telephone pole doesn't mean that that I've stopped being a part of the sort of aesthetic of my town.
Right.
No, that's cool.
That's a super cool. Yeah, that's like a powerful wand to wave.
Something that happened sort of during this coronavirus like lockdown quarantine times, I was running a lot in my neighborhood, and I noticed all of these rainbows in windows, and they looked like they were drawn by little kids, and you know, real crude looking rainbows, like come on kid, that's not what a rainbow is. And so I looked it up to see what all the rainbows meant, and it was this this thing that kids were doing that was a sign of hope, and they were putting it in their window so that everyone in the neighborhood could see it and sort of have a little bit of hope. And I thought that was a really beautiful idea, so I just printed a bunch of rainbows, and I didn't know exactly what I was gonna put on it until our governor Andy Beshear in Kentucky, he puts out these briefings, and he begins each one by saying, "We're gonna get through this. We're gonna get through this together." And so I typeset and printed that, and made about 100 posters, and ended up selling around 700 of them total. Oh, whoa. Like when all is said and done. And so now when I drive around, I can still see posters that I printed hanging up in people's houses, like in their windows. And there's a few shops around town that have the posters hanging up. And you know, it really reminds me of that time driving around Nashville, and I would see like my poster, and I would stop and, you know, take a photo at each and every telephone pole that I saw, like, look, there's my poster. And so now I do it in front of random people's houses.
That's super sweet though. Yeah. It's really nice to have that, like, you know, be able to still be involved with like the community's voice, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just felt like something positive that I could do in a very strange time.
When I got into spoon carving, it was like, I don't know, 7 years ago or something. And there were like maybe a couple thousand weirdos on Facebook on this page, like talking about spoons. And then it became like 25,000 in like, yeah, it's this huge group.
Wow. And
so I was wondering if that was a similar thing that happens in other, like letterpress to me seems like this old kind of niche thing. And maybe that's just my perception, but kind of the same amount of niche as like green woodworking or something. And so I was wondering if there was like a big, if that was a trend craft kind of, you know, in the craft world in general.
I would say that I entered into letterpress at a really exciting time. I think not only as a gig poster artist sort of getting to create, you know, these beautiful images that no longer had to communicate the same way. But there was also this this like overwhelming popularity of the aesthetic of letterpress at the time. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, companies like Nike and Anthropology are reaching out to have letterpress work made for them. And that was really, really exciting. But there were also all of these designers and printers that were popping up, and, you know, we were starting to sort of create more of a community that looked like the people that were practicing letterpress. So I think I mean that to say that, you know, there's definitely two different schools of letterpress. There's, you know, the older guys who were maybe printers when they were younger and when letterpress was, you know, just another skill that, you know, that you used. And so that was their like 9-to-5 job. And they kept the equipment when their companies threw the equipment away. And so they kept printing because they loved the process. And then there were young kids. So when I started at Hatch, I was 22, and, you know, the most of the other employees were about my age as well. So, you know, there was definitely a cultural separation between the folks that were working at Hatch and these older guys who were printing. But I think the more that I was around the letterpress community, the more I started to see, you know, folks who were just getting started into the process, and they maybe like looked a little bit more like me instead of being the older curmudgeon printers. They were, you know, younger and interested in new and different ideas. And we all kind of found each other, you know, this is my experience in the process. I'm sure with other printers, it's completely different, but, I found a lot of my crew at, the Ways Goose, which is sort of the letterpress conference. Ways Goose traditionally was the mark of the end of the time when you could print by the light of day, and you started printing by candlelight because, you know, the days were shorter, so you needed to do that. So it would typically happen around the beginning of November, and the master printer would cook a goose for his apprentices as a celebration.
They're like, yay, we can't see.
Yeah. And so that's sort of the history of it. But these days, typically this is happening at the Hamilton Woodtype and Printing Museum in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, which is kind of the official home of all letterpress printers. I found, you know, so much of my letterpress family there. Mm-hmm. Cool. But we get together every year, and you know, it's there are obviously lectures and keynote speeches and workshops, and there are swaps where people trade prints or trade type and things like that. But you know, for so many of us, it's really about going and being close to our letterpress crew and you know, getting to celebrate all the work that we've made and share ideas and secrets and all of the good stuff.
Dang, that sounds like such a good time.
It's a great time. I want everybody to be a part of the Ways Goose family, because really it's so much fun. And I joke because my wife Adrian has never been to a Ways Goose, and you know, she knows how special it is to me, and and she's always said that I don't let her come with me, but the truth is I am actually working, even though I'm having like all of this fun, and I think maybe I've made it unappealing for her to come, but now I really want her to come. I feel bad.
The main reason Brad agreed to this interview was just to do a public call to Adrian to please go to Ways Goose with him.
Yeah. And most of my letterpress friends are like, where's your wife? Why isn't she here? She's a lot cooler than I am. I would say for the past 10, 11 years, I think that the Ways Goose has been going on. It's just been this amazing, amazing place to see everybody and catch up and really like be a part of this community that, you know, like nowadays kind of just lives on Instagram, or you know, we catch up with like Zoom meetings nowadays.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
would you say that it's something that's open to newcomers to the field? Like if someone listening was interested in letterpress, is that open to them as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They typically will gear like the speakers towards this broad range of printers and graphic designers. There's you know, there's usually a workshop or two that that would be geared towards like the intro printer. So it may not be this crazy technique. It may just be get your hands dirty with some wood type, something Ooh. Like that.
Yeah.
So Hamilton is actually one of the original manufacturers of wood type. And they are still operating today as a nonprofit museum. And I would definitely put it out there that if you're interested at all in printing or letterpress, that trip is absolute must.
That's really cool.
Cool.
That's
like
really
a pilgrimage.
Cool. Yeah.
it is for sure. And Two Rivers, Wisconsin is a tiny little town with not very much to do, but one of their like well-known things is they are the inventors of the ice cream sundae.
Oh,
What? That's How can amazing. You claim that? I'm not trying to challenge them, but
the challenge comes from Ithaca, New York, which also claims itself to be the home of the ice cream sundae. But I am Team Two Rivers.
I guess it just depends on like whether or not you are like, it's like probably how you classify it. They're like, well, we were the first ones to put the chocolate sauce, the whipped cream, and the cherry. And then the other people were like, well, we added peanuts that were crushed up onto ours. And that's a real sundae.
Mind blown. Yeah. Yeah. Caramel doesn't count. It's hot.
Got him. Yeah, hot fudge or bust.
I have always loved the chocolate syrup that dries and hardens.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good.
That's the best, the little chocolate shell.
Mm. It's so, and it has that like that faint whiff of chemical in there.
Yes. The chemical is what makes it delicious.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brad, what about letterpress satisfies, you know, something maybe you think you wouldn't get from another job or career? Have you had a different job besides Staples?
I was a newspaper delivery boy. I worked at a toy store.
Nice.
I worked at Staples, and then I've printed letterpress for the rest of that time.
Was the paperboy the first job?
Paperboy was the first job. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. So I love that that's like, yeah, that like sharing print with people has been a part of your life from the get-go.
It was a terrible job that I'm so glad that I've had. That I had that experience and that I was like, yeah. I woke up early every morning and delivered newspapers, rain, sleet, or snow.
The worst job I ever had was working at Sonic for 3 hours. Ooh. But that's a, three, that, I can share hours. That another. Yeah, I was employed there for 3 hours. Anyway, sorry, continue.
I hope you got a cherry limeade out of it.
Well, that was kind of what made me quit, was because the computers were down that day, the first day I was training, and I was in charge of making all the drinks, which they have like, you know, 1,000 drinks you can order.
Yeah.
And they asked me, it was like high school kids on rollerblades flying in there, throwing a crumpled sheet of like handwritten orders because the printers were down. And I was sitting there like mixing these different colored powders together. And then it was like a little tiny, like, multicolored atomic bomb cloud would come out of the cup and it'd be like a perfect blue coconut cream slush. And I was just like, this is dark magic and I want to have no part with it.
Dang. Now I want to work at Sonic. Is that
right? Yes.
So before I worked at Hatch, I did an internship at a studio in Knoxville, Tennessee, called Revolution Art and Design. And I was working with this guy, Chris McAdoo, who is so incredibly talented. And he was both printing letterpress and doing digital design. So very similar to what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis now. But I watched him at this time, and it was pretty early in the business and pretty, you know, he was pretty young at this time. And I watched him look at this thing that he loved to do as a paycheck. Hmm. You know, I saw every job that came in, we were so eager to get a poster so that we could, or a poster order so that we could make money. And I said at a really early time in my internship there that I never wanted to feel that way, that I never wanted to have a print shop that that was something that paid my bills. And I always said that, like, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have, you know, whatever 9-to-5 job, and I'll print posters at night, and any time that I sell a poster or I get a new commission, I'll buy more paper, I'll buy more ink, I'll buy more type, so that you know, I can have this great, amazing shop, and I can always just love what it is that I'm doing. And I think that that was, you know, a young 20-year-old Brad with, you know, these punk rock DIY ideas. But there was something behind that. You know, I wanted to be excited and passionate about what I was doing without having to worry about paying my bills.
Yeah,
and
right.
Yeah.
I've, after, you know, 15 plus years of being a printer, and you know, 8 years of doing it on my own, I've turned around. I'm so excited that I can make a living doing this thing that I love. Like, I kind of pinch myself every day that I'm paying my bills printing rock and roll posters and designing alcohol packaging. you know, that's pretty exciting. And yeah, there's some value in earning your keep and finding a way to you know, follow your passions and do those things that you really love. Regardless of what that means to, you know, I don't have all of the cars that I wanted when I was 12 years old, but that doesn't matter anymore.
I have a stuffed lamb, which is like a real lamb, and that the exterior is dingy wool. I saw two sheep on an island last week, and yeesh, does that stuff ever collect dirt. I'm no expert, though. Could be cotton, with my need for this highly symbolic fibrous similarity overriding the pursuit of the facts. Picture a hole in a hide not structured to hold the hide, to run the hide or anything else through it. Many holes lack loops, and many materials show stories stripped of use. I tried to write one of my first poems about this stuffed lamb of mine, but I lost it, and all I can remember is the line, "built to last, built to be handed down," which isn't actually true. It would be very easy to pull the thing apart and pulp fibers therein to make paper with, as I have witnessed with the interior of futons. Now that would be new, and would bring these tales of lambs and books to a different realm. Thankfully, there are loopholes that stray away from waste or absence. And our next guest, Cody Noel, is a shepherd of lost leather who is invested in creating products from neglected skins that would otherwise go by the wayside. Cody lives in rural New Hampshire on Abenaki land. She takes old skins and gives them life again, often using raw edges and other parts cut out for the trash heap by larger leather industries. It's a kind of resurrection, if you will, with each wrap bag, clutch, or wallet unique to the hide it was made from, including the ties looped in their holes which open or close them. Unlike my stuffed animal, what Cody makes actually is built to last, made to be used, can be handed down, and she urges customers to bring them back for repair if there's ever an issue. And that's a cycle worth abiding by. Check in next episode to hear more of her story and the nuances that make her at least as unique as what she makes.
So are there any, like, are there any challenges that sort of give you a hard time at all, or is it all just, you're just super pumped all the time?
I mean, I would say that every bit of it is challenging. Like, I can sit here and say that, like, you know, jobs are just rolling in every day, and that the first time that I send a client a design, they love it, and you know, there's no there's no revisions or extra work beyond, you know, the thing that I'm really excited about. But I would say the only one that really, like, manifests itself on a pretty consistent basis is money. I think it, you know, it it is hard to, you know, work on these projects and, you know, sometimes the pay is pretty low, and sometimes another project may not show up. So I think that's something that, you know, I'm totally contradicting what I said earlier. And like, I love that I can make a living doing this, but, you know, making a living doing this is not easy, and it yeah. can be stressful from time to time. And, I struggle with that a lot. And, I also am pretty free of compromise, though. You know, there's not many projects that I do where I don't wholeheartedly love the band or agree with the sentiment of the work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I kind of hold true to creating the work that I want to create. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty tough. But in doing that, you know, maybe I'm not getting the project that would make it easier to pay my bills next month, or, you know, like help with, you know, the rent of the studio or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Right. But at least in that way, because I, and I might have mentioned this on the show before too, but there's another binder who I was talking with named Sam Feinstein, and he was saying like, the one piece of advice he always gives people is just to only do the type of work that you want to do, because that's what you're going to generate more of. Mm-hmm. And right. if you take like other jobs that you're not a great fit for, then, and you do a good job doing it because your name's on it, then people are going to be like, oh, I saw you did that thing that you hated doing for that person and you did a great job. Want to do another one?
Right.
I don't know. Have you had that experience too, Amy?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm always there for some reason. Like I have so many ideas often that I get paralyzed. And I don't know if that's, I'm not sure what that's rooted in. I think I read something about imposter syndrome for like perfectionists.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
I woke up thinking about that.
Really? Yeah. It's really yeah. crazy. And it's nice to have something to kind of be able to identify it. But I think
to validate.
Yeah. To validate like all my yeah. weird feelings I've had about like work and feeling like I can't ever get anything done. And that at least having a name for it helps me be able to kind of work on it in some way, other than just being yeah. like completely baffled all the time.
To like address it by name.
Yeah, yeah.
You can be
yeah.
like, you imposter.
You imposter syndrome. Like, yeah, it's really, it's humbling. And I'm also very interested in just the, I don't know, the process of trying to figure out what the hell, like how to have a business. Cause I don't feel like I have it figured out at all. And it's hard for me to keep motivated when I feel like I have so many different ideas all the time that I just can't do even one of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
Oh, sure.
I don't know what that means.
I've always been the kid who, like when I'm walking down the trail and I see a creek, mm-hmm. I would just rather walk in the creek. And, you know, maybe there's like a nice little waterfall mm-hmm. around this bend. Mm-hmm. And then I think like, oh, well, if there's a nice waterfall here, like I bet if I go around the next one, there's going to be like a better waterfall or a bigger swimming hole. Uh-huh. And I never stop like going around the bend. Uh-huh. And that totally translates to the way that I've sort of operated, like whatever sort of like business it is that I've created. Uh-huh. In that, like, okay, well, I've made some gig posters. Now maybe I can try to sell some art Maybe I could put on my own podcast or something. Like that.
What? <It's,
laughs> I'm gonna call it "Cut the Crafting." Two.
Cut the Crafting.
We can. We'll do your graphic design for it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I feel like now is a good time to talk about creating the identity for Cut the Craft.
Oh, no, we didn't mention it.
Oh, really?
Yes, everybody, big announcement. This is Brad Vetter, who actually did all of our design work, who you hear us thank at the end of every episode.
Yes.
Except this one.
Except this one.
Except this one. Oh, that's too funny.
It was really fun to work with you all on creating that because, I mean, like I said, I want to work with people who are as passionate about what they're doing as I am for the things that I love, like letterpress printing.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I thought... one thing I was very impressed by and very excited about was somewhat hilariously, even though at least I feel like Amy and I work really well together. Amy, do you feel that?
Yes,
way?
Of course.
That was where you were supposed to, that was where you were supposed to come in and reassure me.
Yes,
wholeheartedly.
but it's like, but we do have very different tastes in a lot of things, and so when, for instance, Brad, you sent us like a big list of like, oh, well, you know, it was like a bunch of sort of vague design options or design elements. And you're like, pick the ones that you like. And so then like, I was like, I love this one, and this one. I was like, Amy, what about you? And she goes, those were like the three that I saw and was like, I don't like that one. I don't like that one. I don't like that one. And I was like, oh no. And, but so I was so encouraged though, because we were like, well, here we go, Brad, Amy likes this one, I like that one, you know, see what you can do. And then you came up with the design, and as soon as we saw it, we're like, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what we both needed.
That's what I do. As I like to think that I gave you like a menu of elements for
it was like a menu.
Yeah.
It was fine dining for your eyes.
Would you like a side of textured wood type?
Brad, who is someone inside of your craft that you admire? And maybe somebody outside of your craft as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. This is a really hard one. Because I hear it every week. I hear people give these beautiful answers, and I wish that I could get there. I wrote a list for Inside because I want to make sure to shout out all these people, and then I'll jump back into it. Jen Farrell is Starshape Press. Lindsay Schmidl is Gingerly Press. Allison Fisher is Globe Posters. At Mica, Eric Woods at Firecracker Press, Bobby Rosenstock of Just a Jar, my pal Nick Bowdy from Hound Dog Press here in Louisville, Rick Griffith of Matter, Ben Blunt, and Laura Basden of Camp Never Nice. So those are a lot of my like absolute favorite humans and also just crazy talented designers and printers. If I had to pick one, I would choose from these two. So Bryce McLeod is Isle of Printing in Nashville, Tennessee. I met Bryce while I was an intern at Hatch, and he walked into the shop and I was just immediately like starstruck because I had loved his work so much. And he ended up taking us out for barbecue after I finished that day, mm-hmm. and fell even more in love with Bryce. And he was given a press by his uncle. When his uncle passed, he gave him a motorcycle and a press. And Bryce has this beautiful illustration style. And the way that he approaches printing, it sort of seems to fall like third or fourth as it comes to like the importance of the printing press in his work. Hmm. And number one is the community. And he's always created these projects that kind of have more of a sense of bringing people together than, you know, just creating something beautiful on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. One of the projects that he did while I was in Nashville was he printed all of these paratroopers. So like just a bunch of army soldiers, mm-hmm. and he tied balloons to each of the prints. And on the back side of each of these paratroopers was a number and a website that you could go to. So we all went to this, like it was an old gas station, and he had all the prints inside in the garage door, and everybody grabbed a print. We took it outside, and then we released them at the same time. And I think the whole time that I was there, I was looking around at all of the people, and not one person was, you know, the curmudgeon guy in the corner with his arms crossed. You know, mm-hmm. everybody had a big smile on their face. And I would say that's true for just about all of the work that Bryce has done and the work that he continues to do today. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about the community, and it's all about having fun. And I really love and appreciate that in him.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
He's the best. From a really early point, it was very obvious that like the only things that I want to do are the things that Bryce has done.
I mean, it is so cool though when you have someone who's like good at what they do and is also very into giving back to, you know, their fellow colleagues and people interested, and then the community at large. That's like so important. It's mm-hmm. so nice to when you see someone, you know, because that's like putting it in more people's hands. People are getting super pumped. Mm-hmm. And it's like everyone's transformed from being the old curmudgeon to like a little kid when you have a balloon and a print.
Exactly.
Well, what about someone outside your craft?
So as far as outside of my craft, I've always been a huge fan of ceramics. My ceramics teacher in college is Tom Bartel, who was incredibly talented. He makes these very scary looking babies, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Kind of okay. like monster-y babies. And you know, he was definitely like one of my favorite people, and also kind of sparked that energy in a lot of the students that I was in school with at the time. So we had a lot of incredible ceramicists, which sort of took me to my passion for ceramics today. So like a few people that I love, you can't just tell me to choose one because it doesn't work.
That makes sense. Like you're a letterpress printer and you work in multiple copies.
So Michelle Lynn Strader is Silver Run Ceramics, and they're in sort of eastern Kentucky, like far eastern Kentucky. And I think that her work is absolutely beautiful. It's all hand thrown work with Sgraffito style illustrations on them. And because they have this farm, you know, the imagery is like goats and bees. And right now I'm drinking from a fox mug. And her illustration style is beautiful. The forms are fantastic. And they're just great people living like kind of the idyllic farm life out there. Mm-hmm. Britt McDaniel is paper and clay. She's in Memphis, Tennessee. Kind of the antithesis of Silver Run. It's all like slip cast, beautiful formed, simple pastel glazes. Mm-hmm. And I am obsessed with all of her mugs, and glazing techniques are incredible. And in terms of just like running a business and creating the work that you want to create, like I think that I've always looked at her as an incredible businesswoman as much as a talented ceramicist.
Cool. So.
And then lastly is David Kring, who is in Lexington, Kentucky. And he kind of works in a few different styles. Lately, he's been doing stuff that's very geometric and pattern driven, which I'm obviously obsessed with. And we have a couple sets of his bowls, and I couldn't imagine eating ramen out of anything else. It's just like the right feel, the right size, the all of it perfect. And I probably would get in trouble if I didn't say my wife, Adrienne Miller, is incredibly talented. I say it like I'm gonna get in trouble if I don't mention her name, but I'm overwhelmed by how talented and wonderful all of her work is as well.
Aww.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
Good. It's good. It always makes me happy when people thank their partners.
Yeah.
I always like it when you say stuff like that, though, Amy, because it sounds like you're like automatically cuddling with something. You're like, that's so nice.
It
sounds like you're in like a nice little hug.
I am. I'm hugging it. I am. That's like one of my favorite things about that question is that like most people, if they have a partner, they're like, oh, and my partner, and I love them, and it's wonderful, and how wonderful they are. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
they are wonderful.
Truth.
Yeah. So outside of letterpress, well, maybe you answered this already, but like what else are you interested in? Maybe do you do any ceramics? Do you have ever tried it before?
I am terrible at it. I will just be an appreciator.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
As opposed to a practitioner.
Right.
Yeah, I would say outside of my craft, I love being in the woods. You know, getting out and, you know, running on the dirt, just, you know, walking up a creek or finding a good swimming hole. Like those are the things that that get me for sure. And we got a puppy dog, Juniper Rainbow, during quarantine. So
I wish quarantine had a warranty on it so we could all return that shit.
So yeah, getting to take June out and explore the woods is one of the best.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
And sweet pup dogs.
Something that I've always sort of struggled with as a printer has been like trying to find a way to allow like my aesthetic and the outdoors overlap. You know, that's something I've always really struggled with. Like, they feel like two completely different things. I don't feel like I go into the woods to sketch or get an idea for the next project. It's a lot more of just like clearing my head and being something totally different. My friend who I maybe mentioned in people that I admire, Lindsay Schmidl, who is Gingerly Press, did this incredible project. I think it was last year. It might have been the year before, called The Printed Walk, where she hiked the entirety of the Appalachian Trail.
Whoa.
And while she was out, she would, you know, gather barks and other things that she had found while walking, as well as, you know, the experiences that she had on the trail, whether it was, you know, a storm that happened while she was at the top of the mountain, or getting to see these fuzzy caterpillars. And she created a print for, I believe it was for every 100 miles on the trail, she created a print. And that whole collection is absolutely gorgeous.
Wow, that's awesome.
And
something that, you know, I immediately responded to as somebody who, you know, loves being outside and is a letterpress printer.
And has been trying to bridge that gap.
I know. She's done it, and there's no way that I could do it close to as well as she has.
Yeah. Okay, so if someone wants to see more of your work, where can they find you?
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. so give me a call.
Yeah.
And come to my space if you are ever in Louisville. But on the internet, I am at Brad Vetter on Instagram. As a visual artist, that's sort of the best platform for seeing like work and process and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And bradvetterdesign.com is my website, which you know is pretty up to date. I try and throw new projects on there every now and then just to make sure that it's not stale and boring. And
yeah.
I was on your website yesterday and I really enjoyed it, so it's not stale and boring.
What was your favorite part?
I liked that you had your most recent project where you took over the end of that one hallway with a bunch of posters.
Oh, yeah.
So, booyah. Thought you could catch me, didn't you?
That thing that you printed. That's what I thought you were going to say.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And as a reminder, this is Brad who does the design for our podcast, which we did yet failed to mention until like the very end. So it's really exciting. And it's the first episode of 2021.
Aha, yes, it is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Happy 2021, everybody.
Yeah.
Happy 2021. We're recording this before then, but we're in there now. In our heads.
In our heads.
Our mind palace.
I think we were already there in March.
March. so thank you. Thanks again, Brad.
This is so much fun. And it's so great that you all are doing this and sort of creating this fun platform for folks like me. I know anyone and everyone that I tell about Cut the Craft is happy that it exists, and I'm happy that it's you all.
that's so nice.
Thanks, Brad.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously, thank you. So
no, thank you.
Alrighty. Next up, we have an interview with Stitchcraft practitioner and all-around craft boss, Cody Knoll. And to give you a glimpse into the good times to come, here's a brief clip from that interview.
And actually, the best thing that I've ever done, it was for Gamine this spring. I made some reclaimed denim scrunchies and some naturally dyed scrunchies, and they and I sent them out to her, and she's in Little Compton, Rhode Island, and my best friend who lives in Westport, Massachusetts, so sort of nearby, they got together to do the photo shoot for the items, and they put the scrunchie on a chicken. So if you want to see a scrunchie on a chicken, you should look at Gamine Co. It's pretty much, I don't think that my work has ever looked better.
Amy, Happy New Year!
Happy New Year.
And that about sums it up.
Please rate and review the show because it helps with visibility, especially on Apple Podcasts, I guess, is one of the main ones. And subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone who has taken the time to rate or review us, and to who have commented and tagged us on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Both of those things are extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who has supported us on Patreon. It helps pay for our regular website maintenance and hosting bills. And if we get more support, we can dedicate time to providing you with more content and half handcraft related goods.
Ooh, a little teaser.
I know. Also, as many of you know, we've committed 15% of our donated income to putting money towards craft scholarships.
Yes, and already since starting the show last April, I believe, is when we launched, thanks to the patrons who have joined us since then and website donors, we've been able to raise just a hair under $200. Mm-hmm. Which we've donated to Crafting the Future, an organization co-founded by Corey Pemberton from episode 11 that works hard to promote and support racial equity in handcraft. For more information about the work they're doing, visit their website, craftingthefuture.org. And thank y'all for doing that work. And thanks to our patrons for helping us, spread the love of craft.
You can follow us on Instagram at @cutthecraftpodcast to see images of the work, our future episodes, past episodes. You can, if you click on our profile, actually, you can buy a t-shirt. You can go to any number of our podcast hosting places like Apple Podcasts, Spotify. I'm really proud of that because I just did it. So, and you can find us both on Instagram at Amy_Umble and at @BHBeidler.
Yeah, and as always, thank you to Brad Vetter, who we just interviewed, for the graphic design for the show, for the High Divers / Luke Mitchell for letting us use your music, and Luke for helping with some of the back-end mastering of the episodes, to Justin Williams for his commercial tidbits, and thanks to our amazing sponsors, John C. Campbell Folk School down in Brasstown, North Carolina, and the North House Folk School up in Grand Marais, Minnesota. Thank you all so much. We hope that you all enjoyed listening to it as much as we did making it, and that you had a very happy new year.
See you next time.